What does it mean to unmemorize your story?
Well, as a novelist, over and over again, we mine our lives. However, we create a new reality based on whatever our reality is or what we see in the world. And I think sometimes you write that book over and over and over again, and then we memorize it like it's a song. And because we've memorized it, it's harmonious to us. So as a writer and also somebody who teaches writing, I tell people to take a break from whatever it is that you're working on and unmemorize it. And I think you can translate that also over into how to live a healthy life, because sometimes we're so attached to a story that we've believed it and we live into it, and sometimes that story is no longer true or never was in the first place.
And welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with best-selling author and writing teacher Laura Munson about her novel Willow's Grove. You won't want to miss this. The book is called Willow's Grove, Four Women, One Week, One Question. It centers around four women who've reached a crossroads in their lives and have come to answer one question. So now what? And Laura, unlike your other book, this is not the story you think it is, a season of unlikely happiness. This is your first published work of fiction. How did you get from there to here?
That makes me so happy to answer this question. Thank you for asking it. So I have written many, many books, starting in 1988 when I graduated from college and realized I was a writer, not an actress, a writer, which meant that it was going to take a long time to learn my craft and to sit at that intersection of heart and mind and craft that is the writing life. So I've written, I don't know, I've lost count, maybe 24 novels and a few memoirs mixed in and collections of essays. But it took me a long time before I really knew who I was on the page. And so, strangely, my first published work was a memoir, and it became a New York Times bestselling book and was published in 9 countries. And it helped a lot of people. You know, the short version of it was published in the Modern Love column, and that essay went pretty viral, which is how I got the book deal. But all that said, my heart really belongs to fiction. And while I loved how that message got out to so many people all around the world, I wanted to return back to what I love the most. And I have probably 8 or so novels that I intend to find publication for, but I wanted the next book to be inspired by what I've learned living in Montana and leading my writing retreats.
I'm so glad you made the distinction in two things. One, that fiction is your home in a way, and also the difference between writing and publishing. You can be a writer and not be published.
Yeah, and when I went out to my big, you know, debut first reading and on the Upper East Side in New York City, and I, you know, this was my dream that I'd had for so long, just for fiction, but still, I knew that book had a big message that a lot of people needed. And I remember looking out the window, and here I'm in this big, huge suburban filled with all these, you know, A-list publishing world types, and I kept thinking, you know, I drive a suburban because I live in Montana and haul horses around, but here I am on the island of Manhattan with all these people, this big dream, and I looked out the window, and I thought, you know, no, Gertrude Stein was right. There is no there. And I turned to these moguls and I said, as much as I am so grateful for all that you have done for this book and will be doing for this book to reach many so that they can get the message of it and have it land in their hearts, as grateful as I am for that, I'm now realizing in this one moment that success is a myth which means failure is a myth too. And so that's good news, because the one thing we can control is doing the work. And I said to them, I'm so glad it took me this long to get published, because I know the woman that I am, and I know the message of this book, and I will be a tireless messenger for it.
So let's drop into this novel. Will you read the invitation?
Sure, I'd love to. So the book begins with three women receiving an invitation that they all know that they're going to be getting, and yet they're still avoiding it and dreading it in their own way. So this is how the book begins. On a typical day in their typical lives, three women went to their mailboxes and found, amid junk mail and bills and shiny flyers for unshiny things, an invitation sealed with a bold W pressed into sage green wax. They had been waiting for this invitation. They longed for it as much as they feared it, because to break this seal was to release a behemoth of a question so impossible that they had almost stopped asking it. Each hesitated, looked around, and in respective order thought, "Sweet Jesus, what the hell? Here goes nothing," and slid her finger under the seal, revealing a thick, handmade note card pressed with silvery leaves. Words winked up at them, words that might, if given the chance, change everything. They swallowed hard and pulled out the card. Inside, nestled with a wild bird feather, were the following words: "You are invited to the rest of your life. You know you can't go on like this, not for one more day. You need an interlude." Imagine this. You are in a farmhouse in Montana, wrapped in a soft blanket, sitting by a warm wood stove. There is a cup of tea in your hand just the way you like it. There are women surrounding you who need this just as badly as you do. We all have the same question. The question is, so now what? Come to Montana and find out. Love, Willa. You don't have to do this alone. Each woman held the invitation to her heart, drew in a deep breath before letting out an exhausted sigh that echoed from Connecticut to Wisconsin to California and back to Montana, and went inside to call a dear friend.
So Jane Bliss and Harriet join Willa in the town of Willa, Montana, which is 1 square mile, and the town of Willa has been put up for auction. Laura, the book is essentially divided up into 6 days, and I wanted to know if you could speak to the obstacles each of the women are facing when they arrive.
Yes, I'd love to. You know, it took me many versions of this book before I figured out really what each of their conflict was and how to dive more deeply into the heart of their conflict so that the resolves, if they find them, are authentic. And so really at a certain point, these women wrote the book. When I let over the reins, that's when it became true to me. And so I'd say that each character has a very relatable conflict that either you have in your life, have had, or somebody you know or love is having right now or will have. I take on in one character addiction to ambition. I think that's something that is really real in our society and not spoken about. So addiction to ambition. And another one is faith versus religion, or spirituality versus religion, and how destructive that can be in your life. All of these have to do with identity. And then another one is money doesn't buy you happiness. You know, it brings you comfort and choices, but one of the characters is really struggling with the shame around that, that he or she did everything that she was supposed to do and has this life that on paper is enviable and she's miserable. I think these are all unspoken truths that are the things that we don't talk about, and we need to. And then finally, the protagonist, Willa, she's really based her identity on the Emersonian dream of self-reliance. And she finds out that without her husband, who also shared that dream of self-reliance, that she doesn't feel so self-reliant. And so again, shame. All of these women have isolated because of shame and their disorientation around their identity. And so what about the idea of interdependence? And that's what she explores in this book with these three other characters.
You are a horsewoman, and you brought up letting over the reins. And so what happened when you really entered the world of these women?
Well, so this book is inspired by the retreats that I lead up in Whitefish, Montana, near Glacier National Park, where I've lived for almost 3 decades. And I get to see what happens when people leave home and gather together with a group of people for the express purpose of trying to move forward in their lives. In my case, I'm teaching them writing and how writing can do that. This book is not a writing retreat at all. But when I went in, I was inspired by this idea that temporary community, or what I call bridge community, actually is the very thing we need sometimes in order to bridge to ourselves and then back to our daily communities. And I wanted to capture the essence of that in a novel. And so my first try was way more prescriptive. These women were all very excited to be there and do this work. And it was almost like a recipe that people could model. And I finished it and I just thought, nope, that was not a true novel. That was almost like a how-to book. So I started all over again from the very beginning. And I did some characterizations first to get to know the characters and really understand each of their conflicts. And then I let them tell the story. And they went places that I didn't necessarily want them to go. In fact, there was a lot of resistance from two of the characters to be doing this work at all. And once that happened, the book became real. And these characters became real to me. In fact, a few winters ago, I was walking through the woods and I came upon an aspen grove. And as you may know, an aspen grove is one organism. And that's how these women feel. In fact, they learn that about themselves and they call themselves a grove, which is why it's called Willa's Grove. And I was so excited to take a picture of this grove and send it to these women, because surely there must be a text feed that exists on my phone, right? Surely. So I took, you know, it was winter, so it took me a while to like take off my mitten and put my hand in my parka pocket and pull out my phone and figure out how to, you know, take a picture. Took just the right picture of 4 aspens in this grove. Smiling, I went down to find my messages to text it to them, and I realized they don't exist. And that's when I knew I really had something on my hands here, that these women, they have a beating heart to me, and I hope they will for a lot of people.
I'm so glad you brought up the point about community, because at one point one of your characters says, sometimes our regular community is too hard. And so talk more about, what did you call it, sort of this interlude, you know, of having a temporary community?
Yeah, I'm calling it a bridge community, because these women have isolated, like so many of us do when we're in these big crossroads moments of our lives. We hide, we pretend, we say we're fine in the grocery store when maybe our hearts are bleeding inside. And so I think that our daily lives have people in it that know us so well, and we live in fear of being judged. Maybe we've made a bad decision again. There's just a lot of shame, judgment, and fear of that. And so I think we become islands. And so this book makes a case for these women bridging to each other in this place far from home, at least for Jane, Bliss, and Harriet, and letting Montana be a powerful teacher, but most of all, letting this new community become their teacher. Again, I'm not saying to not rely on family and friends in your community when you're going through a hard time, but you might consider taking an intentional, very deliberate interlude from your daily life, going someplace far away. The poet Emma Mellon says, allow yourself to be spelled differently. I think that's what these women do in this community for the express intention of going back into their lives, more empowered and feeling connected and nurtured.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with novelist and memoirist Laura Munson. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You brought up Montana, so I have to ask, what makes Montana the perfect location for this type of story?
Well, yes, Montana definitely is a character in the book. And, you know, when I first moved here almost 30 years ago, I didn't think I'd last here for more than 5 years. I was a city girl. I was happily living in Seattle at the time. And here I am, almost 30 years later, having raised two children here, lots of horses, lots of dogs. It is my home. And a lot of people don't understand what it is to be in Montana. They think it's being out in nature. And some of these characters even fear that the lessons that they learn here are lessons that won't translate into their lives. And there's a great line in the book that I like to use in my life. And one of the characters says, "I've loved being here in nature. How am I going to be back in New York City?" And the character Willa says to her, "Jane, you are nature." And that's how I feel about Montana and why I set it here. But I think that this book could be set anywhere. It doesn't really matter. It's more about the gathering of these women and the community that they become.
I want to stick with this natural theme, and I was wondering if you would read a part of the book about the snow geese.
I'd love to. Thank you. So there's a point in this book that to me is a real hinge moment in the narrative. And it's when Willa and the women go to see the snow goose migration, which is something I do every spring personally and have for years and years. It's like my spring cleaning. So I wanted to put it in the book. And this is an important moment because this is the first time that Willa does this with this new community, wherein she's not the wife or the mother. She's the woman that she's standing in right now with this big question, so now what? So there's a moment where the women all disperse. They're all experiencing the snow goose migration, which is like 200,000 snow geese that come through here every spring, and like 20,000 tundra swans and thousands of northern pintails. And she's on this peninsula. The last time she's been there was with her husband, Jack, who's recently deceased. So this is the part about the snow geese. There was no one on the peninsula now. Willa walked to it and stood just shy of where her family had stood, looking at the emptiness of it, which was now her truth. Then she saw something at her feet, and she stepped backward, a dead goose, white neck twisted back in a sort of ruthless half knot, a broken wing, and one red spot on its chest. She looked closer. It wasn't blood. It was its actual heart. Someone or something had made a small incision and pulled out the heart and left it. She thought of the story the Lakota told about Custer, how in his vainglorious and murderous and reckless death, the women twisted knives in his ears so he could hear in the next life. Who had held such a knife to this heart? A wildlife biologist? A hunter? An animal? Another grief-ridden widow? She went in closer. No footprints, no prints of any kind. She sat down next to the bird and watched the world around it. Even though the creature world endured its loss so expeditiously, she'd also heard that birds mourned and even drowned themselves after the death of a mother or mate. Would she be that kind of bird? She looked around for some sign of grief in the goose's world, but none of the others seemed to notice or know or care. She pulled one feather from the broken wing, white with a smudge of black at its tip, and twisted it in her fingers. He'd stood there with her. He'd kissed her on the lips while the boys explored the lake. It had been a deep, lingering kiss, and she'd leaned back into his arms, and he'd lowered her steadily and strongly onto the ground where he'd kissed her with his full weight, like he was engraving himself into her, right where she now sat. So she lay back and stretched out her arms, closing her eyes and imagining his weight and his kiss, but it did not feel free, and so she opened her eyes. But there was no freer thought there either, so she stared straight at the sky tide of snow geese ebbing and flowing and thought, "Let them soar or fall." Until they soared her to sleep.
When I read that, it seemed so clear to me that that must have happened in real life. you're free to answer that question or not.
I did come upon a dead snow goose at Freeze Out Lake in Chodo years ago when I went there for the snow goose migration by myself. And I remember treating it as the sacred moment that it was. And I remember allowing it to call me to stop and sit and be, which is why I go to that migration every year, because it has a stop. And the sound of 200,000 snow geese roaring above you, if that doesn't get you on your knees and sitting down, I don't know what will. And there was something about that heart that had sustained that bird for so many miles of migration that felt to me like an offering of some sort that I ought to observe. And I did pull a feather from that goose, from its wing, and I still have it on my desk where I write every day.
In that passage, it references one of the book's refrains, "Think the freer thought." Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is the sort of thing that happened once I started to allow these characters to tell the story the way they wanted to tell it. And it occurred to Willa one morning when she was lying in bed, as we all do, letting all those thoughts come in, all those thoughts that are terrorizing us, that are full of fear and can even stop us and keep us in bed, especially when we're at a time of great loss, as Willa is. She's in grief. And these thoughts are just running amok in her mind. And she realizes how captive she is because of them. And so this idea comes to her, you know, what would it take for me to think a freer thought that could liberate me? And that actually is one of the themes in the memoir that I wrote about learning how the mind both serves and sabotages us, and to find emotional liberation, especially during hard times. So a bit of the message of "this is not the story you think it is," my memoir, bleeds into Willa's Grove here. And she asks herself, what's the freer thought? And she just feels the weight of the world come off of her shoulders. So she brings this down. She practices it a few times on her own in her bed. And then she brings it down to breakfast time and coffee with the women. And she shares it. And so they use this throughout the day and their week together to try to help them not only find out what's next in their lives, but how to do it in a place of more liberation instead of captivity.
You write a letter to the reader with this book where you address a collective craving for increased authenticity. I want to know how you came to learn this lesson in your life.
So anybody who knows me and grew up with me knows that I have always been highly dedicated to authentic self-expression, sometimes to a fault. So I remember being a little girl and always wanting to have these profound, honest conversations with my friends. And when we were little, that's what naturally flowed. And then I can remember a time when suddenly people didn't want to have those conversations. They were inconvenient. Nobody wanted to go there. And so I think that's why I became a writer, because in my journal, I could express myself freely and be accepted there. I have journals that go back to the fourth grade. So when I went out with my last book, the memoir, I ended up speaking at lots of women's conferences, sometimes in front of 2,000 women at a time. And they would come up to me so often and say, "I have a story. I have a voice. You wrote your way through a difficult time in your life in this book. I want to use writing in my life." And then they'd look down and the refusals would come. You know, maybe you recognize these. It would be self-indulgent at best if I wrote a memoir. I would be judged. I would be exposing other people. Who do I think I am? I'm not an authority on it. I don't have letters after my name. And I realized how shut down people are, especially women, I believe, in the realm of authentic self-expression when we know it as children. That's how we start. I mean, unless we've been severely abused, but we know how to let our wild minds go as children. And so what I'm doing in this book and leading my writing retreats is helping people get their finger on the pulse of what it is that they have to say. And I like to say that it's not necessarily the words. The authenticity is what's behind the words and what's in between them and what's left in their wake.
Like Willa, as you've mentioned, you run gatherings for women. And on your website, you write, "You have to be obsessed if you're going to live the writer's life." What do you mean?
Well, my literary hero, who by the end of his life became my friend, Jim Harrison, and he used to say to me, "Writing, if it's one thing, is obsession." And I totally agree. And it's an obsession about how to navigate this beautiful and heartbreaking thing called life using the written word. It's an obsession with wordplay. It's an obsession with self-expression, story, all of that. That's my language.
Another word that struck me on your website is vulnerability. And you write, "Vulnerability is vital to our human experience. We don't have to be alone. That's why the book art form will never die." How do you speak with such passion and confidence?
Well, only just because I've been doing this for so many years. Honestly, just day after day after day, book after book after book. I know the power of the written word. I know how it can create major shifts in people. And that's what inspired one of the lines from the book. One of the characters says, "You know, we're all fluent in this language, in the language of community, and yet we so rarely speak it. It really is our mother tongue."
My last question, Laura, is for those listeners who might feel like, oh, they can't relate to what it means to be a middle-aged, presumably white, maybe a fluent woman. What's the deeper call?
Every single time I lead my writing retreat, the group of women, and there's seven or eight of them, say to me, "There's no way it could be like this ever again. We're your best group, right?" And I have to say to them, every single time, it's just like that, where these strangers come together and they get to know each other better in just a matter of days than many of them know their families and friends. And I have to believe that there's some sort of magic that happens when people are that deliberate about taking time away from their lives to try to help each other move forward in their lives.
Laura Munson lives in Northwest Montana. She's the best-selling author of "This Is Not the Story You Think It Is." She's also the founder of Haven Writing Retreats and Workshops. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.